Welcome to the War College here at 2015 CelesticCon, everybody. My name is Dana Lombardi. I'm hosting the War College. And our speaker today is Leland Erickson, who's been here before. And he's doing a talk right now about the first Korean War. And he'll explain why that's not the war you're thinking of.
That's right.
All right. Leland, please.
Thank you, Dana. This is actually the Imjin War of 1592 to 98. And this is what occurs when we have a serendipitous coming together of one person's overriding ambitions, the complacency of the Korean court, and a Ming China interested in maintaining a nice, stable imperial status quo. The conflict began, the conflict began in 1592. The run-up is essentially the 150 years of Japanese Civil War. Japan had not been a unified country since the Kamakura Bakufu in the immediate aftermath of the Second Mongol Invasion attempt. So lots of samurai warfare, and what brings us to around 1590, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who had been a peasant, a sandal bearer, as it were, for one of the aristocratic warlords, Oda Nobunaga, had emerged from this period of civil war to become the final unifier of Japan. It was a very shaky unification. Hideyoshi had on his hands a whole country filled with independent warlords, or very previously independent warlords, with many tens of thousands of experienced, well-equipped, well-trained, well-led samurai and professional foot soldiers known as Ashigaru. So Hideyoshi had two things going in his head at this point. Number one, I've never lost a battle. Number two, what do I do with this sack of wolverines that I have on my hands known as all of these daimyo? Any one of them might look at me and go, you know, I'm just a peasant, or I'm a peasant. I'm not descended from one of the aristocratic or imperial lines, so I can't be shogun. They've given me the title of Taiko, which is essentially what we Westerners might think of as protector or defender of the realm. So my control, my rule is very shaky. I have an infant son who's set to inherit. And because I married an aristocratic woman, a woman with some imperial blood in her, technically he will be able to inherit and become shogun, but that only works if all the daimyos go along with my plan. And I'm kind of old, so I need to make a move. I need to scratch more than one itch. And, you know, I am unbeaten, so I know what I'm going to do. The Mongols tried to invade us. Well, I'm going to return the favor, as it were. I'm going to send a letter to the King of Korea, King Sanjo, and I'm going to say, hey, I'm going to be the next emperor of China, the next son of heaven, to sit on the dragon throne. So let my armies pass through your little neutral country. Yes, I know you're a loyal vassal of the Chinese Ming Dynasty, but you know what? I'm going to be the new boss, so best just side with me right now. Wile E. Coyote style, basically, you may as well give it up now because you haven't got a chance. I'm just too great for you. Well, the Korean reaction was one of, you've got to be kidding. This is a quick summary here about Hideyoshi and what he had. So he's the unified Japan after 100 years, to recap. He has 500,000 veteran samurai and Ashigaru under arms. They're armed, they're armored, they're professional, and they've been fighting as long as they can remember. He has the ambitious daimyo. What am I going to do with these guys? They're all warlords in their own right, and most all of them claim some kind of aristocratic lineage. And I have never been beaten. I am invincible. So, 16th century samurai warfare and the methodology, and this is what plays a large part in Hideyoshi's confidence, it has evolved into from individual samurai strutting forward and declaring their name and looking for a worthy opponent for a duel on a battlefield, and then enough duels get going, it tended to degenerate into a giant brawl. Well, it's evolved into a very systematic affair, very tightly controlled maneuvering of tactical units, high degree of discipline and training, regular drill. Armies maintained year-round, equipped at the expense of the daimyo, oftentimes uniformly equipped for the wealthier daimyo who could afford to do so. And of course, as you can see here in this period depiction of the Battle of Nagashino, firearms have been introduced courtesy of the Portuguese. And this is a critical battlefield weapon system for the Japanese armies of the late 16th century is the matchlock musket, the arquebus. They have evolved their own system of use, their own tactical deployments, including volley firing on command and even rolling volleys from multiple ranks. In this case, at the Battle of Nagashino, Oda Nobunaga, Hideyoshi's old boss, and Hideyoshi was there, and probably had a hand in it too, since he was considered a master of training ashigaru, or the common foot soldiers, had equipped his arquebusers and trained them to fire and discipline volleys. This was a new stunt in Japanese warfare, and he pulled it en masse at Nagashino. They fought from behind field barricades made of bamboo, lashed together and sunk in the ground. And also there was a stream that ran across the battlefield. So they chose the terrain carefully. And again, tactical considerations, very sophisticated. Japan's got very rough terrain, not a lot of arable land, it's very mountainous. So it does require tactical, a certain amount of tactical finesse and situational awareness once battle is joined. And they tended to have it in abundance. So what happened in Nagashino is the Takeda clan, with its vaunted heavy shock cavalry, raced forward, as they always did, and they tended to bust through the opposing line and roll them up like a carpet. Instead, were gunned down systematically. It's depicted in a very dramatized fashion in the Akira Kurosawa classic film, Kagemusha, The Shadow Warrior. So, am I getting this the right direction? No, I'm not. This way. Here we go. This is a reconstruction of what the typical samurai and the upper tier ashiguru were equipped with at the time of the invasion of Korea in 1592. The armor they're wearing, notice it's much simplified. There's not a lot. There's much less lacing involved. Fewer metal plates. The plates are metal. They are lacquered to protect them against rust because Japan can be very humid and rainy. And notice they're uniformly equipped. The crazy-looking helmets, that's actually a papier-mâché crest that's been lacquered gold. This is a showcase parade unit. That crest would be removed. Underneath, you find a very simple black helmet bowl. The armor type is actually referred to as bulletproof. And against a matchlock, it actually rather is at longer ranges. In fact, armorers would show the proof of the armor by actually firing several test rounds at the armor and leaving the dents on the armor and lacquering over it as a proof to the purchaser or to the daimyo who contracted for it that, yes, as a matter of fact, this armor offers protection against bullet strikes. Here's another look. This is how they are in campaign. The little white balls are actually a tube. It's a cloth tube. And tied off at each ball, to create each ball, is a measure of rice for one meal. So it's his ration pack. It has a straw sleeping mat rolled up. Notice the samurai, he's not wearing elaborate boots or anything. He's wearing simple straw sandals for better traction when you're actually in a foot fight. Unusually, he's armed with a matchlock. Usually the samurai left the matchlock to the commoners, the ashigaru. However, some samurai recognize that this is the cutting-edge technology, and it's wise to know how to use it and use it well. Interestingly enough, that cylinder hanging next to his hand holding the arquebus is a canteen. Again, this is very sophisticated. They've really gotten down and dirty. There's a fair degree of standardization of equipment going on. This is a very disciplined army. Each of the daimyo's armies, they're quite disciplined. Oh, excellent. Thank you. They're quite disciplined. The little flag they wear in the back, sashimono, literally small flag, it's a bamboo pole. It inserts in a tube here, or these metal rings in the back. This is their way of identifying individuals and units. Typically, the common rank and file would bear a flag depicting the crest and arms of their particular daimyo. Samurai who had some degree of rank and status might be allowed a personal crest, or a variation of the lord's insignia or colors, or perhaps a banner with simply their name written on it in kanji. These are the foot soldiers. Again, these are professionals. Originally, they would be peasants recruited seasonally, kept under arms just for the summer, spring and summertime, and then sent back in time for the harvest. No longer. Hideyoshi abolished the right of peasants to carry arms, to keep and bear arms. The great sword hunt is what he initiated. What he did is he basically disarmed the countryside. Those Ashiguru, the best of the best, were retained as bottom-tier samurai. They were given the right of the daisho, the two swords, which were the badge of status of the samurai and exclusive to them. Only they could carry it. So this is in transition. These fellows actually have a dagger and short sword, but these are professional Ashiguru from around 1600. Eventually, they would get the proper katana as the availability became more prevalent. And eventually, they became all indistinguishable. It was simply a matter of how much money you had as a samurai in your family, how much of a holding you had. Notice their gear, much simpler. Again, this is supplied by their daimyo. It usually carries his colors and crest as a means of uniform identification. And again, very simple equipment. This fellow is holding a jingasa. It looks like a peasant straw hat. In fact, it is a metal helmet. It's lacquered metal. It could also be used on campaign for cooking your rice. This is how disciplined they were. This is a reconstruction of the firing line at Nagashino. Notice the arquebusiers are working in three ranks. They're systematically rolling forward in ranks, firing on command, rotating back to reload, and when necessary, replenish from a special, if you will, like an NCO equivalency, Ashiguru, whose job it is to maintain a bullet and powder box and maintain the supplies. They've even thoughtfully got a bucket of water because this is hot and thirsty work. So and note too, they're supported on the open flanks of the palisade by spearmen, whose job it is to keep back and also counterattack any of the Takeda cavalry that managed to get it through or try to go around in the gaps. This was absolutely devastating, this tactic, and they would bring this with them to Korea. Again, another view of this reconstruction of the firing line at Nagashino. And again, as you can see, very disciplined, systematic training. It's not willy-nilly. It's not like some of the early militias we saw in the English Civil War at a later period. This is quite sophisticated. Japanese naval assets were mostly ore-type vessels. They were coastal vessels. They were essentially like medieval European ships, fighting platforms for soldiers. There are no cannons. This is a smaller one. No cannons in evidence. The oars men are actually kind of exposed, though they are at least one concession. They're wearing body armor, though they have no head protection. And again, you have a number of Ashiguru and a samurai officer. They're armed with matchlocks. Again, the matchlock is their principal missile weapon at this period, and fired in volleys as far as the Japanese are concerned. This is more than sufficient to get the job done. This is the Japanese seamanship, if you will, which the Chinese and Koreans are familiar with. These are wako, literally dwarf pirates. Though ethnically, they tended to be a very diverse lot. They tended to be a mixed-up bag of Chinese, ethnic Chinese, even Thais, Indo-Chinese, such as basically today's modern Vietnamese, and Koreans, as well as Japanese. But they tended to affect Japanese-style garb, Japanese weapons, which the swords in particular were the most efficient in this part of the world at this time. They would raid the coastal villages and towns up and down the Chinese and Korean coasts. And they had done so for many generations. And so this was essentially the Korean perception of the Japanese, a bunch of pirates. These are some larger Japanese warships. Again, as you can see, even with all these firing ports, they're simply for firing ports for musketry. So essentially, the Japanese warships of the period are different iterations of the same theme, a fighting platform to provide for a floating weapon station, if you will, for lots of arquebusiers, and of course, when necessary, boarding. So you have spears with boarding hooks and so on, and of course you might have gunpowder flash bombs, etc. So this is the Japanese where they stand. This is the Korean perception of them. This is what follows next. Hideyoshi sends his Wile E. Coyote letter to King Sanjo. This is how they see them. A bunch of ruffians and pirates. You know, who are these guys? He said, what? You know, WTF, LOL. You've got to be kidding me. So they just basically toss it in the circular file. This is nonsense. Well, I mean, they're pirates, right? What a nerve. We have real soldiers. Now, these are modern reenactors at a Korean historical site, but they are equipped quite correctly, as far as we know, with typical Korean regular soldiers at this time and period. Nice uniform attire. They're skilled in the use of bow, a halberd, a spear, perhaps. They have a wicker shield. Notice there's no body armor. Their only head protection is a felt hat. But that's fine by the Koreans. For the most part, as far as they're concerned, any real threat is far to the north of the country from the nomadic Jurchen. So the best of the best Korean soldiers are in the north. They're the guys that have armor. They're the guys that are equipped very much like the Chinese neighbors. Their job's to deal with the Jurchen, who are a real threat. They're a real army. The Japanese, bunch of pirates, if they show up, we'll arrest them. That's the attitude, except for one person. This is Admiral Yi Sun-sin. In fact, this is a particular image is from a Korean historical drama of Admiral Yi Sun-sin. He is a national hero in Korea. He is quite an amazing person by anyone's standards. By all rights, he is one of the greatest naval strategists, tacticians, and innovators in naval history. He knew the Japanese and what they were capable of firsthand because he was a commander of one of the Korean fleets. He dealt with them. He dealt with the pirate problem. He understood them far better than King Sanjo and his courtiers and was trying to sound the alarm, but really nobody was listening. So Admiral Yi, on his own authority, mobilizes his fleet. He's like, you know what? I know what's coming. No one's listening, but at least I and my fleet will be prepared. To this day, he's venerated in Korea. And once we get through this lecture, you'll fully understand why there are massive bronze statues of Admiral Yi Sun-sin in Korea and why he is often referred to as the Nelson of the Far East before the Japanese Admiral Togo Heihachiro was given that moniker. He's a quiet guy. This is one of his one of the inventions attributed to him is what is perhaps the first armored warship in naval history, the Kobuk-sun, literally turtle boat. This vessel has iron spiked plates covering the entire roof of the vessel. It's built out of very thick timber, thick enough to stop a musket ball. And notice something too here, and this is the kicker for the Korean Navy. Cannons. It's armed with cannons. Okay, there we go. This is a modern reconstruction of Kobuk-sun. Now, remember, the Japanese style of warfare is fire some musket volleys, get up, grapple, jump on the enemy ship, and start taking heads. Imagine you're wearing straw sandals and you jump onto the back of this thing. First of all, ouch. Second of all, if you do manage to dodge the spikes, you're not getting in anytime soon. It's all shut up, buttoned up, tight. So good luck with that. This is the Korean army up in the north on the frontier facing the Jurchens. So equipped in this fashion, much similar to the Chinese of the period. But again, the armor, it's not as the uniformly consistent across the board. Shields are made of wicker. The principal missile weapon is a bow. It's still the bow and arrow. Yes, there are handguns akin to the old medieval European handgun, basically an iron tube on a broomstick, and you point downfield, you ignite it with a burning match and hope for the best. This is adequate for keeping the Jurchens out of Korea's mountainous territory and kind of keeping them on their side of the boundary. And the Koreans have some innovative artillery, such as the Hwa-cha, which is a rocket arrow launcher. And if you've ever followed Mythbusters, they back-engineered a Hwa-cha and demonstrated it. You can pick it up on YouTube. It's quite something to see. One of these, not so much. Six of these, maybe, hub to hub, firing downfield at a tightly packed group of several thousand soldiers advancing in rank. Ow. Not funny. It works. They had Koreans had, again. This is the Korean trump card, especially in the naval conflict, the cannon. And they fire big iron-tipped arrows, which by the counts of the period were very, very destructive for the lighter-built Japanese warships. They didn't cotton well to getting hit by one of these things. The Koreans were also very confident that their fortifications were going to be along the coast would be more than adequate to keep out any Japanese invasion attempt. This is a period depiction of the Japanese landing. It was, well, we'll see how good those fortifications really were. Again, the attitude was, they're a bunch of pirates. This is a really good reconstruction of showing you a typical band of Wako attacking a Chinese village. This is a Ming soldier one of the pirates is giving the coup de grace to. But as you can see, it's a mishmash of Japanese and rags and whatever else they picked up, scavenged, fabricated. But, you know, quite easily, this captain could be Chinese. Two of these men are Japanese, another's a Chinese, and one's a Thai. I mean, it's just, they were real ragbag. Again, the Korean attitude was one of, hey, we have this big, powerful neighbor, so if things really do go bad, we're going to appeal to our friends, the Ming Dynasty, and we're going to say, in China, we're going to say, hey, help! And the Ming are going to send their great, mighty, modern army down, and they're just going to flatten these pirates. So we don't have to worry. I mean, they're a bunch of pirates, right? We can handle them. Well, here we go. Hideyoshi's plan, 1592. They're going to go through Korea. The reason is it's much easier. That's closer to Japan, and it's easier for logistically than trying to go direct through landing in China proper somewhere along the coast and, of course, traversing hostile waters. So his plan is he's going to land at Pusan. He's going to march on up to Seoul. They're going to split the army. Well, one half wing of the army consolidates the northwest of the country. The other half of the army is going to continue to march along all the way to Beijing, and Hideyoshi will ascend the dragon throne. Simple. I'm unbeatable. Who could stop me? So they arrive at Pusan. The defenders at Pusan are caught completely by surprise. Even so, their garrison commander, who was one of Korea's national heroes from this war, rallies his troops, and they put up a spirited defense as best they can. But right away, you can see one of the major tactical disconnects of this war. The Japanese are all armored. The Koreans, none. These are just felt hat uniform hats. The Koreans, therefore, are fighting at a terrible disadvantage in any hand-to-hand encounter. Further, their missile weapon is a short bow. The Japanese missile weapon is the arquebus. The effects are devastating. Pusan is quickly overrun. This depicts the garrison commander here in his black armor, Chong Pal, and his personal standard, fighting hand-to-hand with one of the Japanese officers leading the assault. Chong Pal was, again, by all accounts, a very brave man, a fearless fighter, and he went down fighting and really rallied his men in a disastrous situation, at least put up a fierce fight. Even the Japanese supposedly recounted that. They said they were asking after the battle, who was he exactly? He was obviously one of your bravest and best. Well, Pusan falls in short order, and the Japanese begin to advance, and they are going through, in the words of George S. Patton, like crap through a goose. It's not funny. The Koreans are completely shocked. They cannot fathom the Japanese fighting prowess, the technological advantages they're bringing to the battlefield, the tactical advantages they're bringing to the battlefield. They are, frankly, in a state of shock. Panic sets in. The court begins to evacuate the capital of Seoul and starts moving north, fleeing ahead of the Japanese invasion. It is going very fast, and encounter after encounter, the Japanese are dominating the fights.
What was the size of the army?
We're talking.
With the Japanese.
The Japanese sent over something on the order of six figures. Over 100,000 men were committed in several branches, but we're talking initial waves of tens of thousands, 10,000, 20,000. upwards of 50,000 men committed. And again, this is another part of the shock, was the sheer size. You know, Hideyoshi has 500,000 troops that he's drawing from. And again, his goal is, I want them out of Japan and preoccupied, conquering something for me. So he was pressurizing as many daimyo as possible to participate in this. Notably, one managed to make excuses and stay out of it, and that was Tokugawa Ieyasu, who later became shogun. The Pyongyang, essentially the Pyongyang Falls, that's how far north the Japanese reach within the first year. Pyongyang falls and is occupied by the Japanese. The Korean court has literally retreated to the absolute border of their country, where they have been sending frantic messages to Beijing saying, help, we are being overrun. They are moving across the country like, if they knew what driver ants were, they probably would have said driver ants. They said, we just can't stop them. Help us. We're being completely overrun by these guys. Well, the Chinese had just finished managing to struggle to put down a major rebellion in Ningxia, and they had the Jurchens to deal with. So the Ming have got plenty of problems of their own. And the Ming dynasty has begun its story arc descent. So it's beginning to reach the end of its tether as far as projecting force outside its borders. And the sheer cost of doing things is basically reached the critical mass for the Ming. But the Ming recognize the threat and they realize, okay, wait a minute, if these guys are this far north, they're reaching the border with us inside Korea, something's going on here. Either these guys are the big threat that the Koreans say they are, or the Koreans are colluding with them to do this. And either way, this is a crisis for us. Now they are threatening our national security directly. So the Ming pulled together an army, and they send this army down south toward Pyongyang. And they're doing their best to pull it together. When they finally get it pulled together, it's about 40,000 men strong. They're aiming for a higher number. They couldn't, but they had trouble recruiting enough men that were competent. Because again, at this point, the Ming are starting to rely more upon mercenaries and forcible conscription, such as press ganging convicts and so on into their ranks. It's getting harder to get quality material for their army. The court is not willing to spend the money, so it's a struggle. But the Ming are bringing a surprise with them, as we will soon see. They got the technology of their own to introduce. The Ming, initially, though, the Ming are very, very confident in their ability to handle this problem. They are a professional army in their own right. It's a very highly disciplined army. Standardized drill. These are professional soldiers maintained under arms, sometimes for basically their life, for the length of their duration of their able-bodied life. But they have high confidence. They have put down a huge rebellion in Ningxia. They have kept the Jurchen at bay. They have every reason to be confident that they can deal with the Japanese. Their understanding of the Japanese is the Korean perception. They're a bunch of pirates, which is why they suspect the Korean king is colluding with them. That the only reason they're this far north is because he let them get that far, and he's really just pretending. This is a big deception to try to set us up for a sucker punch. So the Chinese go down and they meet with the general. Li Rusong meets with the Korean king and his court, and at first it's a very hostile meeting. The Chinese are convinced that these guys are up to something. This is too easy. It does nothing. Something smells wrong here. This is not standing up to scrutiny. Well, the Koreans manage to persuade the Chinese that no, this is really happening. These guys are that dangerous. In turn, one of Li Rusong's subordinates is so confident of their ability to handle the Japanese, he leads about 2,000 cavalry in an attack on Japanese-occupied Pyongyang, which holds a garrison of roughly 10 times his size of his force. And initially, he causes a panic. The Japanese had no idea that the Chinese army had come down already and was this close, let alone parked outside their gates. Well, they weren't prepared, and the Chinese initially caused a panic amongst the Japanese troops. And then the Japanese figured out, hey, wait a minute. Where's the rest of them? Hey, wait, this is just a, this is not a large force. Pull yourselves together. So they did, and they proceeded to turn the tables on the Chinese very quickly, and the Chinese were driven out of Pyongyang, badly pounded, with that cavalry commander, a new understanding of the nature of the enemy they are now facing. But again, the rest of the dragon is coming. That was just his whisker. And the next thing the Japanese discover in the course of this chronology is there's an army of about 40,000 Ming Chinese parked outside Pyongyang's walls, and they are quite large. It's a large army. It's larger than the garrison by a good margin. It's clearly very professional. It's deployed. This is a Japanese depiction based on eyewitness accounts, and you can see how the Chinese army is deployed in distinctive formations. It's clearly denoting discipline and drilled troops. And yes, the dragon breathes fire. This is what the Ming bring. Cannon, nearly 400 cannon with their army. Sizes ranging from small crouching tiger guns like this that one or two men can port up to much larger pieces. And they're firing either stone or iron cannonballs. Ming army.
How big is that? How big was that?
That particular gun would probably fit neatly on this table. Okay. That was a fairly small weapon.
Less than 2 feet long?
Probably around about 3 feet.
It's firing a ball that's what?
About yay big.
Okay.
And it's about the size of an overlarge softball.
Gotcha.
But now multiply this by several hundred.
Okay.
And then add in even bigger and bigger, successively bigger pieces, which are mounted on carts. And you get the idea. So
even if you're an armor, it's going to knock you down. If it doesn't,
the concussion alone will kill you. It's quite lethal, as the Japanese quickly discovered. The Ming soldiers, as you can see, wicker shields. They have some lacquered leather or metal body armor, as these modern reenactors are wearing. Weapons are of decent quality, not unusually different from what the Japanese are carrying. Here's a modern reconstruction. Chinese soldiers actually wear a form of brigantine armor. Basically, it's lacquered leather or metal plates, and they're riveted in place underneath a cloth, in between two layers of a cloth sandwich. And at least they have body, protection for the torso, upper and lower torso, sometimes the legs. The head protection variables. Most troops had felt hats, though others had helmets. It just depended on the troops and their status within the Ming army. The fellow on the right in the white brigantine, you can see he's holding a triple-barreled handgun. This was a typical Ming weapon, missile weapon. So this is, again, they're mostly at the level of the handgun, whereas the Japanese are using the matchlock. This is one of the disconnects. Chinese armor is actually in its own right quite sophisticated. This is a more elaborate piece that would have been worn by an elite cavalryman or a low-ranking officer or even a general. And this is all metal plates sewn onto leather or cloth backing. So it forms a flexible but effective defense, especially against cutting weapons. Again, Chinese weaponry, the principal infantryman's weapon, the long spear. So a match, at least on paper, for the Japanese with their yari or lance. So now we have the chronology of 1592. It basically runs a cycle of disaster, Ming China intervenes, and the Korean hero emerges. So May 24, Pusan falls. May 25, Tongnai falls. The 31st, Gyeongju falls. By June 10, Seoul falls. You can see why the Koreans are in a panic. Boom, 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 one after the other like dominoes. Their cities are falling. By June 16, we have the naval battle at Okpo. It's one of the initial clashes between the Korean fleet of Yi Sun Sin and the Japanese. The Koreans destroy 37 Japanese warships. They lose none. And this is where we're going to see a pattern set quickly that will play out consistently, almost without fail, throughout this entire war. The next month, we have on the 8th of July, we have the Battle of Sa'on, and the turtle ships are debuted. And again, the score is Korea 26, Japan 0. pardon me for sounding like the World Cup announcer there. We have, by August, on the 14th and the 16th, we have two battles in rapid succession. Han Sando, followed up by Angol Pol. And again, the total count is Koreans 82 destroyed for the Japanese, who inflict zero loss in return. Again, the Japanese keep losing their darn fleets. And then, of course, by July 24, we had the first Chinese attack on Pyongyang. That was the impetuous cavalry commander, and that, of course, failed. The naval war. The naval war here, again, it was... These naval engagements were always intensely fought. The Japanese, remember, these are highly confident, trained, drilled, and usually veteran fighters of at least one or two battles in Japan. So they go into the fights with high confidence, at least initially. They are taken off by surprise by the effectiveness of the Korean Navy, especially its cannon. And so the result is that this is the backbone of the Korean Navy, actually. This is the Panoksan. It's essentially a giant, thickly timbered, blocky-built war galley armed with cannon and with fighting stations for archers and for foot soldiers with various pole arms or swords and boarding actions. But it is a very stout, well-built ship. It's ideal for its intended role as a coastal warship. The Koreans have got coastal sailing down. They've been doing it generationally. Many of the sailors in the Korean Navy were recruited from fishing villages, so they were already experienced being out on the water, being in a boat, even knowing how to swim. So, again, this is a big technological disconnect, and though the carnage you see depicted here in this reconstruction, this is essentially how these naval engagements ran. The Japanese would try to swarm the Korean ships, which were usually far less numerous, but it never worked quite as well as they would hope. Here we have a turtle boat taking on the Nihon Maru, which was the flagship of the Japanese fleet. The Nihon Maru was basically, as you can see, like a small castle mounted on a ship, a giant galley. Well, it got damaged enough that it was forced to withdraw by an encounter with a turtle boat, which basically unceremoniously rowed up to the Nihon Maru and blew a hole in her side. So in order to prevent this ship from capsizing, they had to get the heck out of there before anything worse happened. The land war, again, we have another dynamic in play here. The Japanese daimyo, in charge of the two main armies, hated each other's guts, both personally and religiously. One was a Christian convert, the other a devout Buddhist. They saw each other as essentially religiously loathsome and personally insufferable. And so their cooperation was not always quite what you see depicted here between this meeting in the field between these two daimyo. The daimyo were all ambitious. They all wanted to be the first to bring down Korea and give Hideyoshi what he wanted. Because they knew if they did that, they would rise higher still. The Japanese were setting in to stay. In fact, they were not shy. They not only took the forts over on the coastal areas, they expanded on their defenses over time, building what they called Wajo, or basically a coastal fort. But they also used captured Korean cannon, which the Koreans themselves had not used with much effect in the initial invasion because they'd been taken by surprise, so they never really had a chance to get going with them. But the Japanese, for their part, were not shy about at least using captured cannon in defense of their ill-gotten gain. Meanwhile, the Korean defenses are just not so effective. The Japanese keep attacking Korean fortified towns and cities, and they keep bringing them down, wearing them down, and storming them and winning in the end. This is an actual incident that occurred at Chinju in 1593. Kato Kiyomasa was racing to be the first to have his banner on the parapet, because if the first guy that got the banner up is the guy that got the credit for taking the place. Well, his rival was going to beat him to the gate, and seeing this, his loyal bannerman threw his lord's flag over into the walls. Therefore, he was the first to raise his banner on the wall, and he won the foot race. This is a typical Korean defensive wall. As you can see, it's not particularly tall. It's not particularly, it's not offering a lot of protection. Yet the Koreans thought, oh, this is adequate. We can use this to keep them at bay. I mean, it's mountainous terrain. It's enough. It works. I mean, bandits don't like it. It's got to be just right. You can imagine what happened the first musket volley that went in on the defenders standing up there on the parapet like that. The Koreans, in turn, as things were falling apart, the Koreans began to rally and form what were called righteous armies. And these were built around sometimes entire coalitions of Buddhist monks who basically, patriotic Koreans, decided the Japanese were cruel barbarians, they were unrighteous in the eyes of what was right and proper in Buddhism, so we must fight back. So they quite literally took up arms and would form their own righteous armies, their own militias, and then try to rally patriotic Korean peasants. They would try to find soldiers who had retreated from falling garrisons or defeated in battle and get them to join them. Regular Korean officers would come in and try to would assume leadership positions of these righteous armies. And they would essentially wage war, mainly in an asymmetric fashion against the Japanese as the Japanese occupation solidified. So they would attack supply columns. They would raid patrols. They would ambush patrols. They would try to set up an ambush if they saw a unit moving from A to B. They just in general try to make things as hot for the Japanese as possible. And there's an old saying amongst my late in-laws from the islands, if you don't hear, you're going to feel. And this is what happened at one of the Japanese, one of the few great victories that the Koreans experienced in the land war. The Japanese attempted to attack a much smaller Korean garrison at Namwon. And what followed was essentially this. You had about 2,300 soldiers plus their dependents at the top of this hill fort, this hilltop fortress. Very steep slopes all the way around. They also had about a dozen Hwacha present. The Japanese had something on the order of 30,000 troops present. The Japanese commander took one look at the small, paltry size of the garrison and concluded that the logical solution was a simple direct assault uphill in dense columns, that they would simply overwhelm them. So they proceeded to march up the hill because it was too steep to run. You had to slog your way up. Very steep mountainous country in Korea. So you had to slog your way up in column. All the while, the Koreans proceeded to shoot at you with hwachas, lob rocks down on you. In this reconstruction, in the lower of the picture, you see the Korean women bringing their menfolk more and more rocks in their aprons. This, in fact, is what was reported went on during the siege, is that the women participated by bringing the men as many rocks as they could gather. So between the rocks, the hwachas in particular, the Koreans savaged the Japanese army that attacked them. The accounts of the casualties run as high as 10,000 dead out of 30,000 troops committed. It was an absolute debacle. The hillsides were just littered with the Japanese dead and dying and before they withdrew. So this was a major victory, and this was a major shot in the arm to the morale of the Koreans. This little garrison had quite literally taken advantage of the terrain. In fact, in the distant center of this this reconstruction, you could see just how steep these slopes are that the Japanese attempted to assault in column. And just perfect, if you will, the perfect laboratory conditions for the Hwacha and what it was meant to do. Especially, as you can see here, firing enfilade. It's just a debacle. Then, of course, the Ming have arrived. They are laying siege to the various Japanese-occupied forts and cities. and the Ming are masters of siegecraft. And in this depiction of the winter siege at Ulsan, it shows you some elements both of the Chinese equipment, that this was a professional and effective army in its own right, but also the ferocious discipline of the Ming army. Those mounds that the Ming have set their scaling ladders in, those are the dead bodies of the previous attack waves. They've just been covered with snow. The Ming actually let their own bodies of their own people sit there and freeze, and they use the mounds as a way of making the distance to the parapet shorter. And they just kept, by the Japanese accounts and the Ming accounts, they kept attacking and attacking and attacking. And you might also notice some of the damage depicted here to the Japanese. They've taken the original wall and they built a wooden Japanese-style palisade on top of it. But you can see some cannonball damage coming on different spots of it if you look carefully. And that's also why the banners are tattered in many places. In fact, one near roughly left center, it looks like a pretty large ball went through it. Again, the Chinese have very sophisticated siege craft. And here you have what's called a cloud ladder, which is basically a giant hook and ladder affair. And they're using a movable shield to guard the troops deployed on the cloud ladder to let them get right up to the wall before they drop. Again, you can see the cannon damage to the wall. Some fairly large balls have passed through it already. The typical Japanese timber fortification, as you can see, is pretty much inadequate to a defense against Ming cannon. So, a summary for 1593. The pendulum swings back. The siege of Pyongyang began, and it ended after 9 days. The Japanese decided this is not working, and they retreated all the way back down to Seoul. The fighting, is characterized by the rude surprises for both sides. Japanese swords go through Ming cloth or leather armor all too easily. The Japanese arquebus, even easier. And the Chinese are not happy to encounter Japanese arquebus fire. In turn, the Japanese are appalled by Ming cannons, especially because there's so many of the darn things all banging away at them. It doesn't matter if you're holding a 1,000-fold sword, wearing armor worth 10,000 koku. If you get clipped by one of these stone cannonball or an iron cannonball, it will ruin your whole day, and it doesn't matter how imperial your bloodline is. So again, heavy losses on both sides. The Chinese due to the arquebus, the Japanese mainly due to cannon fire. The Battle of Pyongyang, this is the largest land battle of the war. This follows in the aftermath of the Japanese retreat out of Pyongyang. The Japanese win on body count. The Ming army was led by Li Ruosong himself. But the thing is, although they won the battle, and it was a very hotly contested battle and a near-run thing in which Li Ruosong himself was nearly killed, and he was only saved by one of his brothers, one of his subordinate officers who was his brother, quite literally using himself as a living shield against Japanese spears and swords to save his brother's life. The Chinese put up a hell of a fight. The Japanese realized that we can't stay, and so they continue to retreat. So in essence, Pyongyang is a tactical victory for the Japanese and a strategic victory for the alliance of the Chinese and Koreans, because the Japanese retreat continues. The Japanese then, as I mentioned, they attacked Hangzhou. Then they went on to Hangzhou, and this is where they got clobbered by the tiny garrison of 2,300 Korean regulars and monks. They literally charged right up the hill into the teeth of the Korean Hwachas, and they paid rocks, and they paid for it again and again and again. And this was a really humiliating defeat for the Japanese. Then we come to the second siege of Jinju. Again, the Ming are back, and they're back with a vengeance. This time the city falls, This is a Japanese second attempt to take Jinju. The first time they were repulsed, they try again, the city falls. The Japanese are in no mood for kindness, and they quite literally slaughter thousands of civilians as well as the garrison. But the Japanese retreat continues. It's meaningless. The taking of Jinju is basically meaningless in a strategic picture. So they continue to retreat, And it continues to the end of the year, where they finally wind up occupying only Pusan and a network of coastal forts, the Wajo. And this constitutes their entire occupied territory for the next 4 years. They're dug in. They're not budging. The Koreans and Chinese are licking their wounds and regrouping and reorganizing, and the diplomatic wrangling begins. The Chinese in particular are eager to get the Japanese to leave without any more fighting because it's expensive. And maintaining this army down in Korea is costing us a lot of money that we really, really, really need to keep our books balanced at home. So, and of course, this is consistent with a Chinese strategic way of waging war. Sun Tzu wrote in his Art of War, "The acme of skill is to win without fighting." So if you get your enemy to do what you want him to do without having to fight him, that's the best way to do it. Well, the diplomatic wrangling goes on for 4 years. Guerrilla warfare continues across Korea for 4 years. Because the Koreans, well, they're not so patient. They're kind of like, you know, we don't like having these foreign occupiers here stealing all our food, abusing our women and children, killing us. You know, it gets a little old real fast. So we want them out. So in the meantime, though, court intrigue in the Korean court winds up taking Admiral Yi Sun Sin and getting him convicted of false charges of treason and imprisoned.
Admiral, right?
That's correct. He's imprisoned and he's tortured. Yeah, this is the guy that's handing the victory after victory after victory, but some sleaze bags in the Korean court convince the king he's really a traitor and that's all made up and it didn't really happen and he's really going to turn on us. You'd really have to do something about him. And the king buys the hokum, and so their best guy is arrested, beaten, tortured repeatedly to confess for things he never had anything to do with and would never consider, and left in prison to rot. He nearly dies. He gets very ill. He nearly dies in prison. So they left their best guy rotting in prison during these 4 years. The wrangling the diplomatic wrangling produces no results. Hideyoshi is not going to settle for anything less than the Dragon Throne. Period. End of. The Chinese and the Koreans, they want these guys gone, but Hideyoshi is not going anywhere. In fact, he's pressurizing his daimyo to commit more troops. Both sides are, of course, trying to regroup, build their strength up, and wait each other out. But again, Hideyoshi, he couldn't take no for an answer. So, finally, 1597, Hideyoshi says, enough is enough is enough. End this. So he tells his generals, you get in there, here's the plan, here's what we're going to do, we're going to put an end to this thing once and for all, we're going to crush the eastern half of the country, which we haven't been into really before, we're going to subjugate it, we're going to take the heart of Korea and just make it our own, and we're going to break the back of these Chinese and Koreans, and then we're going to march on to victory. So this is the plan, we're going to do this. We're going to come on in from Pusan. Reinforcements are coming in, and we are going to go on up and work our way around and just boom, boom, boom. We're going to just suck this whole belly out of the country and put an end to them. We're going to crush anybody that gets in our way. So that's the cunning plan. Well, doesn't quite work out, does it? As the old Prussian wisdom goes, no battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy. So we have a succession of the battles of Namwan, Hwang Sokan, Chiksan, and win or lose, the Japanese still cannot shift that strategic pendulum. It won't budge. They gain a tactical victory. They can't stay. They can't hold it. They're too strung out. Admiral Yi is reinstated after Korean naval disaster, where the admiral in charge panicked and burned his ships. Rather than once he got engaged with the Japanese. He basically freaked out, burned his ships, and everybody swam ashore and ran away. And it was a complete debacle. Well, the Korean court, in a panic, the king finally gets the truth. He realizes he's been played for a fool. He desperately reinstates Admiral Yi. Admiral Yi comes back. He proceeds to win against incredible odds. at the Battle of Huang Sokang, which is depicted in the movie The Admiral, which is available to rent, by the way, with English subtitling, and I do recommend it. Admiral Yi had 12 ships. He attacked a Japanese convoy of 300. He broke their backs and sent them running. And they were that was the fleet that was intending to move up the coast and seize.
How did you do that? That sounds like propaganda.
Actually, superior knowledge of coastal waters, superior technology. Remember, Korean warships have cannon. Japanese ships have no cannon. Now imagine the disconnect right there. You have a wooden warship. You have guys with muskets. Your opponent has a wooden warship with timbering twice to three times as thick as yours. Much heavier ship, much stronger ship. It has cannon. Your muskets can just maybe get through the can't get through the planking in the sides of those Korean ships. If you hit somebody through a gap, through a firing port, or who stands and puts his head up over the side, great. But you cannot fundamentally damage that ship with your muskets. He, in turn, is firing iron-tipped giant wooden arrows and cannonballs that punch through the side of your ship like basically my fist through a paper wall.
But he has 12 ships. When you run out of cannonballs before, he actually really does a lot of damage.
Actually, it didn't take much. You got to remember, two Japanese ships tended to be lighter built, smaller size, and plus you're not taking into account tactics. Admiral Yi understood the terrain of the coastal waters. Korea has these treacherous currents in some areas. Local sailors know the currents. The Japanese didn't. And that was one of the factors that the Koreans used to stage their hit-and-run attacks. Further, it's in a move that's very similar to what the Athenians did at Salamis. He canalized the Japanese fleet through those coastal waters. They're maneuvering through those coastal waters between the islands and so on. He's hitting them at key points. The Japanese don't know he's only got 12 ships. Number one. Number two, he does damage in a narrow band that the Japanese cannot respond except in a roughly equal numerical fashion. So it's like Horatio at the bridge with his two companions when they're gladii and escudo. The guys coming at them are not equipped for that kind of in-your-face hand-to-hand combat. Those three Romans were, and you couldn't get around them. So it's the same concept. Is essentially how he rolled, and then of course the cannons are just pounding. One ship after another ship is capsizing. What's the effect on the Japanese morale? Remember, their confidence has become shaken at this point because of all of these lopsided naval victories that the Koreans keep pulling. It's not a question of run out of ammunition. It's a question of can your ship take the pounding? They can't. It's not like, say, at Trafalgar, where you had naval technology that was on parity. So your ship of the line, the French ship of the line, could take the pounding that a British ship of the line could take. So it really became a question of skill and gunnery and accuracy. Well, now imagine it's happening. The ship on one side doesn't have that structural strength and doesn't have the means to respond in kind. So it's a very lopsided paradigm. You really don't see a lot of this in warfare, except maybe gunpowder versus a non-gunpowder army. It's quite remarkable, really. So they keep cutting their supply lines, and this is the other problem with the strategic picture. Admiral Yi and his navy keeps cutting the supply line. The Japanese cannot get reinforcements through. They cannot get supplies through. They're trying to, those troops that are in Korea are trying to live off the land. Well, there's not enough to go around. So the garrisons are starting to winter, through the winters, are experiencing starvation and outbreaks of disease. And they're not used to the Korean winter. Korean winter is brutal. It's very cold, especially in the mountains. So all of these things are coming into play to wearing down. Remember, year after year they're doing this. This is wearing the Japanese down strategically. And they've reached a critical tipping point by 1597. They just can't get past the Korean Navy. And so this was the decisive edge strategically for the Korean-Chinese alliance, was the Korean Navy. And the fact that they had an admiral, Yi Sun Sin, who understood his advantages and the Japanese weaknesses, who understood the nature of his environment in which he was fighting, the coastal waters of Korea, understood the currents, understood how they changed, understood the locations of the different islands and so forth. Understood the best optimal places to launch attacks or launch ambushes. Understood the best way to use his ships, much as Nelson understood how to use his ships at the Battle of the Nile. You might follow that, Dana, that parallel. I mean, I read a description of how the British maneuvered their ships into firing position at the Battle of the Nile, running those anchor lines through the entire interior length of the ship, out the back of the ship, in order to cause the ship to literally come to a screeching halt and spin on a dime. It was astonishing seamanship. This is where the Koreans are at, as coastal sailors. They handle their ships with a degree of professionalism and precision the Japanese are very hard-pressed to match. So 1598 is the final year, and we really see the whole thing fall apart for the Japanese. They capture Nanwan. They capture the whole of Chola province, which is, this is the eastern portion of the country that had previously been spared. The Japanese claim they killed as many as 10,000 Koreans and Chinese. But again, it doesn't change the overall strategic paradigm. Battle of Chiksan, it's a seesaw battle. It's back and forth encounter between the Japanese and a massive Ming Chinese army. It was a strategically indecisive once again. They basically, the Korean and Chinese garrisons that were defending the forts and cities they occupied, they snapped out of the post-Nanwan battle tendency to panic at the approach of the Japanese. So they would stand their ground now, and they would resist, and resist well. Basically, now the Japanese find themselves confronted by a huge Ming army that is deployed to defend Seoul. And so again, that intention, we're going to get that capital, comes to a screaming halt. They just can't win for trying. We can't get our supplies through. We can't get our reinforcements in because the darn Chinese or Koreans keep cutting off our fleets, destroying our fleets. We can't get past the roadblock that's the Ming army. It won't get out of our way. We beat it. It comes back. And it brought more cannon. Those blankety-blank Ming cannon. We just can't budge these guys. They just won't leave us alone. And we are short of food. We cannot replace our losses. It continues to grind down. So then finally, the last straw. Toyotomi Hideyoshi dies. And essentially, the daimyo who are left to run his affairs for his infant son, they go, probably privately behind their fans, are going, "Thank God, this crazy fool is gone. Okay, we're going to get out of there." So let's just tell the Koreans and Chinese, okay, look, it's been fun, it's been real. Just let us withdraw. We're going to leave. Just leave us alone and we'll pull out. Well, Admiral Yi's like, "Oh, no, you won't. You can't just waltz out of here after what you just did." So he refuses to lift his naval blockade. So the Japanese send a 500-ship fleet to run the blockade and evacuate the army. Well, he intercepts them at Nouryang. And here is where Admiral Yi wins what is considered his Trafalgar. He wins his greatest victory. He has a fleet of around 150 ships. He is confronting 500 Japanese warships of all sizes. He accounts for 450 in that one battle. He tore them apart. However, tragically, and much like Nelson, at the moment of his victory, Admiral Yi is struck under the arm by a Japanese musket ball and mortally wounded. But he has, like Nelson before him, he orders his subordinate to cover him up and get him below decks and don't let the men see that I've been hit. And apparently a junior officer took the admiral's armor, put it on, and went back and stood on the bridge so everyone else in the fleet would think that the admiral was still there. And that is an artist's depiction of Admiral Yi at the moment he was mortally wounded by the Japanese arquebus ball. No one's quite clear where it came from or how. But again, it's a stunning victory. And again, the elements as I described were all in play. That disconnect. The Japanese never adapted to the Korean naval way of doing things. They never got it. They just never seemed to get that cannon on warships equaled victory and decisive victory. They just never got their heads around it. And this was a huge contributing factor to the victory of the Korean-Chinese alliance. Because the other part of that equation is that, like the Allied victory in World War II, it was not won exclusively by the Korean Navy, as certain nationalist writers post-war had insisted. The Ming contributed a substantial presence to the land war. 40,000-50,000 troops, that's the size of the Hessian contingent in the American War of Independence, and that was one-third, if I recall correctly, of the entire British commitment to the War of Independence. You can't just blow off, you know, something that substantive. And the fact of the matter is that the Ming army stalled, and initially stalled, then ejected, and drove down to the coast, and then finally just stopped in their tracks the Japanese advance on Seoul and any further conquest. So between the Koreans and their fleet and the Ming army on land and the grinding effect of the Korean asymmetric warfare of the righteous armies, the Japanese simply could not win in the long run. This is an unusual monument in Japan. It's known euphemistically as the Ear Mound. It is a tourist attraction. The custom at the time of the Japanese was to prove to your lord that you had done your job and defeated the enemy, you presented him with your enemy's head. Well, transporting all these Korean and Chinese heads back to Japan, of course, is logistically just not practical. So they went ahead and cut off noses and then pickled them and sent them back to Hideyoshi. Well, supposedly so many thousands of pickled noses that were supposed to be of Korean and Chinese fighting men, though most likely included a lot of civilians, were sent back, that Hideyoshi decided to have them all buried and had this mound put over them, and then in turn erected a Zen Buddhist religious stelae to commemorate the victory in Korea. And this so-called ear mound, which you won't find in any of your typical tourist brochures, still stands in Japan today and is a bone of contention between the Koreans and the Japanese governments for obvious reasons. In Korea, he is rightly remembered as their great national hero. Yi Sun-sin is, by all accountings, and I first read about him when I was about 9 years old. I discovered an article in a back issue of the United States Naval Institute's Proceedings magazine. My dad worked for the Navy, so we didn't have Life magazine. We had on our coffee table. We had Proceedings. I read an article called "Lord of the Turtle Boats," written by a U.S. naval officer, and that's how I first learned about Admiral Yi Sun-sin. And I was floored then, and I've been fascinated with him ever since. And he is, by any and all accounts, one of those exceptional military leaders. In some ways, quite the visionary. Certainly a shrewd and astute strategist and operational commander and tactician. This is a man who went from victory to terrible personal defeat to great victory, and ultimately at the cost of his life. But he played a pivotal role along with the Ming army. He and the Ming army were the two pivot points that turned this entire conflict around on the Japanese and eventually drove them from the mainland. So the movie's out, The Admiral. I recommend it. Even Korean cinematic hyperbole aside, it is still a good watch. It does give you a sense of the rivalries within the two camps, the internal challenges of leadership, and also you see acted out, it is in a dramatic fashion, but you see acted out how the Admiral was able to take on 300 ships with 12 and trounce them thoroughly. So, thank you all. Sir, question.
Okay, so you had that map at the very beginning that showed that the Japanese, the closest and probably the easiest way to get to Korea was
that island between Japan and Korea, and then hopping is another short distance into Korea. But I wonder why there was no option. Here we go. Why there was no option considered to go through the Yellow Sea and land closer to Beijing, or you know.
The option was rejected, Dana, for several reasons. The first reason is that the Japanese are coastal sailors, and they're not even necessarily as, I mean, they're good, but that numerically, there weren't that many of them comparatively to, say, the Chinese. The Chinese were used to dealing with piracy. The Chinese, if you look at the coast of China, it is literally, it's riddled with Chinese garrisons. There are Chinese, there will be major Chinese fleets at the various port cities like Shanghai. The Japanese basically concluded that if we went up through the Yellow Sea and tried to land closer to Beijing, we are going to be running into a degree of, first of all, it's longer distance. We're going to be moving up waters we're not necessarily that familiar with. We are going to be, there are greater opportunities for the Chinese to be alerted and come at us at sea on in terms of their choosing. So, and in addition, we want to take Korea, and it's the old classic shortest distance between two points. Our biggest asset, our strongest asset, our absolute overwhelming strength is our land army. So the quickest way to get the land army onto the mainland is to go across through Tsushima and straight into Korea, get our army there, get it there in as big a state ready of readiness as possible, as high a state of readiness as possible, and then proceed to march up. Meanwhile, because we're so awesome, and again, we're dealing with Hideyoshi's ego, we are so awesome, the Koreans are bound to side with us. Because the Koreans, you know, who are they? They're a bunch of little mountain-dwelling peasant knuckleheads. They'll fold. I mean, our pirates beat them up all the time. So what chance do they have against samurai, against real soldiers? So the reasoning, the line of thinking that was most likely going on, given what is written, what we do know from primary sources that survive about Hideyoshi in his later years, the man was definitely showing signs of somewhat paranoid thinking in some ways. He supposedly was paranoid about his infant son, had the child watched constantly 24/7, doctors on call, the whole nine yards, to make sure his one heir, his one known blood male heir, was going to survive and inherit. He was absolutely, and rightly in some ways, aware of and concerned about all his daimyo, and are they going to continue to toe the line? Will they back my son? I'm an old man. I don't have a lot of years left. Will I be around? I won't be around to see my son reach adulthood. I need to be sure, as much as I can be, that when I shed my mortal coils, these chuckleheads are going to do what I ask them to do, keep their word, and back my son. They're not going to pull the rug out from under it. And he had every reason to be suspicious, because there were, in fact, daimyo who were very much plotting against him. And in fact, what the most notable one, whom I mentioned earlier in the presentation, was Tokugawa Ieyasu, who conveniently managed to make excuses and stay out of the Korean campaign. So therefore, he kept his troops out. He kept his troops from being worn down by the Korean campaign. He kept his strength while some of his neighbors were forced to go. So Ieyasu was able to stay out of it and bide his time, because Ieyasu saw the writing on the wall. He knew Hideyoshi wouldn't be around much longer, and he just had to dance the dance a little longer with his peers. And when the time came, and it came, it was in 1600 at the Battle of Sekigahara. And that's what's dramatized in the novel Shogun.
So did Hideyoshi's son grow up at all?
Hideyori grew up. He ostensibly was going to reach manhood, and just before he would reach his majority, Ieyasu basically had been busily maneuvering the daimyo that were responsible, the council of daimyo that were responsible for making sure Hideyori, inherited his basically his birthright left by his dad. He caused the council to split into two factions. the other faction led by Ishida Mizunori, and basically Ishida and Ieyasu, there was no love lost. They were open rivals. Ishida wanted the power himself in many ways, but he couldn't figure out a way to do it without being seen as a usurper. So instead, he probably was thinking more along the lines of, I'll put the kid on the throne and I will have the strings from behind and I'll pull the strings. The upshot of that was the Battle of Sekigahara, which has been called Japan's Culloden War. And Ieyasu crushed opposing daimyo at Sekigahara. And that, Dana, is a lecture we should do another time. Because I think you would love what went on there. Because that was a case of know your enemy as you know yourself. And know who will turn sides at the peak when you tell them to. And that was pretty amazing. But anyway, bottom line was you cannot rule out the personality of Toyotomi Hideyoshi in this entire affair. It was his ego that launched it to begin with, his ego, his political concerns, and it was his ego and his political ambitions that kept it going even after the point of strategic no return. You had a question, sir?
Did China have the same kind of boats as Korea had? The turtle boats?
No turtle boats, but their warships are very similar to the Korean ships. They were basically coastal vessels, or powered, but with an auxiliary clinker sail. Think more like a Chinese junk, but built fairly thick and strong for fighting. And like the Korean ships, they carried cannon as a matter of course. So they're cannon-armed warships.
I still like the idea of going up the Yellow Sea, hitting Beijing, taking Beijing, and then as you're marching back, you're getting closer and closer to Japan instead of further away.
To us today, living in the modern world, as denizens of a technological society where armies move supplies with mechanization, that is absolutely the logical course. You go right for the throat. This is not that paradigm. This is an agrarian civilization. So everything is tied to successful harvests or failed harvests and the ability to feed yourself season to season. Food preservation is a difficult thing. And having enough to eat requires the peasants are in the field rather than in the ranks. I mean, there's a whole lot of considerations. If you were at Sun Tzu's Art of War, I'll go back and read it. What he says about the cost of sending a soldier to another land, how much it costs in terms of grain, because you have to feed the guy that is chivying along or driving the cart that's carrying the grain, and if it's an animal pulling the cart, you have to feed the animal so much grain, and so by the time you go so much distance...
Wouldn't they be living off the land, though?
Here's the problem. The first year, you're doing fine living off the land. The second year, there's no food to live off of, because what's happened is twofold. You have completely disrupted local agriculture, because the peasants are fleeing before you. The ones that remain, you take their food. They starve during the winter. What's left? No one's left to till the land. That season, there's nothing to eat but weeds. So, again, if you remember, this is a span of 1592 to 98. So, the first year, it seemed like everything was great for the Japanese. They weren't having trouble finding food, because there was plenty to steal from the locals. But once they stole it all from the locals, and they did not appreciate the nature of the Korean winter, which is much harsher than that in Japan, you need to be able to keep your belly full to survive those kind of sub-zero temperatures. The Japanese armies have taken that away from the Korean peasants.
So their goal was like a permanent occupation.
Yeah, they thought they could walk into Korea and treated exactly like any other province in the much warmer Japan. They thought this environment was this environment. This paradigm was this paradigm. We can go in and we can handle it just like we handle our own business. Square peg, meet round hole. It's very similar to the disconnect that occurred, the psychological disconnect you had with the Mongols invading and occupying China. One of the great Mongol failures, where they caused all kinds of disasters and famines and catastrophes for for several generations as they occupied and ruled China, the Mongols did not psychologically understand sedentary agrarian society. They did not comprehend the value of peasants. So the Mongols tended to continue to prey on the Chinese peasants at will. They tended to kill them out of hand because they could, and take whatever they had because I'm hungry and I don't feel like hunting. And the net result of these Mongol armies raging across China, even after the fall of the Sung and the ostensible assertion of Mongol imperial authority, it created famines, it created chaos, and it took the Sinification of the Mongol Yuan dynasty to finally grok that no, peasants are not only useful, they're critically important because they make this whole civilization thing work. They produce the surplus grains, the surplus foods that we can preserve through the winter that allows us to feed blacksmiths and lacquerware people and scholars and artillery forgers and weaponsmiths and generals and maintain standing armies. They are the bedrock of the civilization. And we are continuously killing that bedrock. And it's the same impact. The Japanese had no appreciation for the nature of the terrain they invaded, for the nature of the society they attacked. And they paid for it, along with all their tens of thousands of victims.
We're going to take a break before your next talk begins, but what I want to do is we got some giveaways, some freebies.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
You were wise to return, Tom.
All right, so I actually have one of the things I'm giving away. Look, very appropriate. Chinese Yangtze
gunboats. That's a good one.
Navy, okay, cannon.
It's a good one.
Just a couple of 100 years difference, okay? So what we're going to do is you get to decide what the question is, and the person who answers the question gets the book.
Okay.
It's got to come from the talk, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. This is a fun one.
Don't make it too hard.
No, I won't. I'll try to make it a challenge, but not overpowering, because I know Korean place names, they make me crazy, too, and I actually understand the rules of pronunciation, and I still screw them up all the time. Let me think of a good one here. Okay. I know I can do a true or false, Dana.
Go right ahead.
True.
Well, yeah, but they can yell it out. So the problem, you got to give everybody a chance to answer.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah, you're right.
Then I have to give it to everybody.
Oh, well, that's why'd you bring enough coffees?
I know.
Anyway, all right. Let me think this through. One second. I got one forming in my lizard brain. Does anyone remember the final score of Admiral Yi Sun Sin's great and last victory, his last naval victory? Does anyone remember the last score? Uh-oh, I got three hands up, Dana. Okay, we'll start with Tom.
Was it 450 and 500?
Okay,
yes.
He got it.
Okay.
Well, I gotta do something. We gotta do something nice for these two gentlemen because they may also know it.
Well, we have one. Hang on, I actually have something for everybody.
It was.
I got two copies of Hazel Wars.
Oh, okay. There we go. Because it was 450 out of the 500 that he destroyed.
Yeah,
I mean, he had
150.
That's correct. He had 150 of his own. I mean, that, you know, you stop to think about that. I mean, Nelson's achievement at Trafalgar is astonishing, but you go out at a fleet that's over three times your size and you rip it to pieces. I mean, it's under. When I first read that, I'm thinking, what the hell happened? The samurai are not chickens. They fight like crazy people. I mean, what are these Koreans doing? I mean, are they 12 feet tall and covered in an armor plate? You know, I mean, what is this?
What, did they have better guns and gunpowder?
Here's what you keep in mind. I'm Japanese. I'm shooting at you with a musket. You're Korean. You're replying with a cannon.
Right.
Okay, I mean, it really is kind of like the old, you know, show up at a tank battle with a pistol. Okay, what do you think could possibly go wrong? You
know? Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't worry.
Yeah, no, what could possibly go wrong?
You're on the right.
And the thing is,
the Japanese army that is smarter than the other ones, because that was their withdrawal plan. That was their Dunkirk.
Well, that's essentially the army. What happened is the Japanese, with the death of Admiral Yi, it opened a window of opportunity for the Japanese, and they pounced on it. They were able to get their people out in the end. So they have succeeded in evacuating most of the remainder of their armies from Korea without any further trouble. And part two, that came from the Chinese. The Chinese sent a fleet to help the Koreans, by the way. They were supplementing the Korean Navy. But at this point, the Chinese attitude has become, again, that Sun Tzu tradition. The acme of skill is to win without fighting. As long as they keep going in the right direction, we're just going to keep shadowing. We won't engage. And, of course, this was the Koreans. This was driving them crazy because the Koreans want to fight. You know, they're like, this is our land. We've got to drive these barbarians out. Look at all the people, our women and girls they've outraged. Look at all of our people, our children, our parents, everybody they've slaughtered. These are monsters. We've got to drive them out. We've got to wipe them out. But the Chinese, because they're the major partner in the land war, the Chinese become more sanguine about it, especially after those initial battles where they're getting beaten badly, and they're going, you know, these guys are dangerous. You know, the Koreans were telling the truth. These guys are incredibly dangerous. So the prudent thing to do is, when they do stop, we stop, deploy the cannon, start firing downfield, and remind them to keep going. Okay. And so that's how they operated.
We're moving into your next time slot, so you got to finish up. Go ahead, ask two more questions.
Two more questions. Okay.
Well,
did the two Japanese the two Japanese commanders of the mainland armies, the two Japanese commanders, what was the problem between the two of them? Do you remember what the problem was with the two of them?
It was a problem of religion. One was the Christian, and one was
a devout Buddhist.
Devout Buddhist, and they didn't get along at all.
That's right.
That's right.
21. Sorry. One more.
Okay. What happened the first time the Chinese attacked the Japanese? The very first time battle encounter. What happened? Can you tell me what happened? First Chinese, they engage the Japanese. They flat out attack them.
Chinese lost?
Yeah, but why? Do you recall why? The why of it?
They didn't use the cannon? Mm-hmm. I missed
that part. Yeah. No. Let's see if you remember.
They were grossly outnumbered in the end. Initially, there was panic among
the Japanese.
The Japanese,
right.
They thought the Chinese are here, but then when they saw that they outnumbered that initial force
about 10 times, they're like, "What is this?"
Right.
Right.
Okay, do you want again?